Okay, well, I'm really pleased to present introduce our next speaker, Eva Butler. She is the founder and program director for Sacramento Splash. And Sacramento Splash helps children value their natural world through science education and outdoor exploration, and empowers them to take an active role in the protection of the natural world. So please join me in welcoming Eva.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. I waited 4 years, recognizing that the last time I was here for half a day was not long enough. I'm really excited about the theme of this conference was sort of looking backwards and looking forward. And as I was kind of doing the calculations, I realized, wow, we're having an anniversary at Splash. We've been at this formal education thing for 20 years. And I realize it's been 25 years since we've been active at Mather Field. So I just, really the subject of my talk is not so much about Sacramento Splash and what we do, but really kind of what this process does to get kids tuned into nature and empower them to take an active role in its protection. So in my talk, title of my talk, I said that this is falling in love with vernal pools. I'm just curious, how many people here, put up your hand if you would admit to being in love with vernal pools or something in them? You know, I think it's a characteristic that we share, and part of that love is that we have the opportunity. You know, we've been shown them, we've spent time in them. But most of the children that live in California now do not have that introduction. And when I look around this room and I look around, you know, the people playing in vernal pools and attending conferences, I see a lot of graying hair. I don't see the diversity that I wish we would see. And I realized that when I was taken out to see vernal pools for the first time at Mather Field, I was sort of set to be not very impressed. But it's that love that grows on you, right? The more you know, the more you want to know. So I first went to Mather. George Clark took me there in around 1995, three, I guess. For those of you who aren't familiar with Mather Field, it's one of those Air Force bases that was undergoing that conversion from military use to civilian use. And in this slide, you can see if I can figure this one out. When I first got involved, the county's plan for this piece of property was to gravel mine it. And they had an aerodrome planned for someplace in here, an Olympic stadium, you name it. It was going to be a free-for-all. And at the same time, the conversion, the land, the conditions the land would be given to the county by the DOD, Department of Defense, was that a preserve be established and it be managed for the benefit of the species. So I was kind of curious. We'd had a lot of loss of vernal pools on private land early in my tenure with vernal pools. And I was curious, you know, if what will it take to actually preserve these on private land? I mean, sorry, on public land, you know, land that's essentially owned by the people, what will it take to make sure that those pools survive us? So this is an aerial view of Mather. You can kind of see the developed housing area. So it's it's now a preserve. It took about 30 years to do the conveyance, mostly because our county saw fit to do things unbelievably slowly, which has had its downsides for the habitat. The upside is we've had 25 years to mobilize the community to figure out if this was the community was going to come forward and save this. We had the time to build that community and constituency. Well, back, I think, in the, maybe around 1994, I was a volunteer with the Native Plant Society, and we were already taking people out to Mather every spring, really trying to build that constituency. If you look very closely at the kinds of people that we would bring out, they all looked a bit like me. They were scientists or people who were educated. a little bit more affluent, very white. And it was going to take a really long time to get there, because bear in mind, we didn't know how much time we had. We thought this would move pretty quickly, and we needed to move quickly. But if you look kind of beyond us, and you start looking at the children of California, you start to see that, you know, when they learn about this stuff, you know, it's a unique experience. Most of these children do not go outside. And as you sort of look at the makeup of these populations, what you recognize is many people who live here have come from somewhere else. I came from New England. Many of the kids that I see, their parents maybe came here as first-generation immigrants, or you don't get to go very far back and discover that this is a new place to many people who live here. You know, the San Bushmen have lived in the Kalahari for 200,000 years or more, learning that landscape and learning who's home and how they can work together. But most of the people here haven't actually been here very long. So you look at the barriers to access to the outdoors, and you typically see things like fear. You know, fear of the unknown, and fear can go back multiple generations. If you arrive here and there's you're not physically or socially or culturally safe, and you don't have people to take you to these places, then you don't go there and you don't take your children there or your grandchildren. So when we started Splash, it was really to get a program into schools where we would reach the full breadth of the demographics of the Sacramento region. And in fact, in the years since we started 20 years ago, we now do 104 classes of fourth and fifth graders. And when we look at the demographics of those classes, they mirror exactly the demographics of Sacramento. So when it comes to trying to reach out beyond our normal borders, schools are an amazing place to do that. And so, you know, it doesn't take much, as you know, to meet a vernal pool and start to meet who lives there, and you fall in love. It's just a natural thing about the biophilic human species. And once you fall in love with something, when something threatens it, boy, you care. And I see that care develop very quickly in the children that we serve. And I've seen, you know, examples too numerous to mention, but you know, in this case, you know, people are driving four-wheel drive vehicles through what would become a preserve, and you know what, the kids looked around and said, "How come these vehicles come out here? Why doesn't somebody do something?" Oh, and the bureaucrats, you know, they say, "Well, we don't have signs. If you don't have signs, you can't cite people." So the kids went, "Well, we'll get money and we'll put up signs." So they did, and then there was, you know, other excuses for why we couldn't catch the culprits. But, you know, getting out there and feeling like you can make a difference really matters to these kids. This is an area, a terrace at Mather that's a younger terrace. It's about 50,000 years old. And when we used to take people out there, as you can see, all the serpentine interconnected pools and swales, if you're on the ground, it made it hard to figure out what direction to go and not have to walk through water. So if my second class of students... they're 10-year-olds. When this boy in the red shirt was 17, I got a call on my cell phone. I was in Maine at the time, and he goes, "Mrs. Butler, this is Derek Gotchin. You know, you probably don't remember me," but and I go like, "Oh my God, Derek! Of course I remember you." He's like, "You do?" Which is when I realized kids have no idea how much they affect you, right? So he said, "I need to do an Eagle Scout project. And I know it's been, you know, 7 years since I knew you, but my parents asked me, well, geez, you know, you've got to get off the dime and get this done. What do you care about?" And his answer was, "I care about vernal pools." That was a class, you know. That was not that much effort to have yield that much benefit. And he and his Cubs, his Boy Scout group put... they put markers into three loops so we could find our way around, and they built these 16-foot arched redwood bridges to span the swales, and basically turned this into an area that we can use, and we are using, you know, today, to get kids out to other vernal pools. So, you know, as scientists, I have my degrees in ecology and environmental economics, but also I'm in integrated pest management, and I've been in the science world professionally for a long time, and I remember what we were taught about writing and communicating as scientists. You remember, you never use the word I. You know, you always talk in a third person or somehow dry it out so it doesn't seem personal. And I'm really here to say that I think at some level it's time to change that story, because we all talk amongst ourselves in that language of professionalism, but the people that really need to be hearing these stories that connect them with these beings, they are not hearing that message. We don't even put it out there. We have conferences amongst ourselves. So when I wanted to tell kids about vernal pools and hope that they would mobilize to protect the ones at Mather Field, at least, I realized that we had to find the language to do that. And, you know, when you want to have the experience of something, not just read about it, not just hear about it in the third person, you really want kids to get down and, like, touch things. So, you know, what we found was that if you give kids fairy shrimps and let them use the scientific method to test the hypothesis, do all fairy shrimp hatch at the same time? Well, they do that quite well, and they figure it out, and they learn to use graphs, and they learn to think and act like scientists. But on a, you know, on a fifth grade level, so each of these children will become the class expert on one plant and one animal in the system as in a 13-lesson curriculum that teachers sign up for. We have a 5-year waiting list that never clears. And so what the trick here is that, you know, connection to all begins with connection to one. All you have to do is feel like you are empowered to know about something and you're the expert and you can share that with other people, and suddenly you're bound to that organism as if it's yourself. I read a letter from some students. We experienced a 25% cut in our funding suddenly in September after pretty stable funding. And it was actually, you know, a mean-spirited effort to silence these pesky people who persist. And, you know, some folks in county government didn't want us in the mix anymore and just kind of managed to remove our funding. So hundreds of people wrote letters to the Board of Supervisors questioning that, and several hundred more students. And those letters from those students, so sixth graders who had the experience of splash and exploring vernal pools the year before, got to talk about how that mattered to them. And I was at a point, I have to say, in September, October, November, where I really felt like, man, I am tired. You know, I am tired of these people. I love this landscape. I love the people that I know. There's so much wonderfulness in the human race, and I am stuck dealing with these jackasses, and I think I'm just tired. And, you know, there's something about that potential for the end, right, where you finally get to look death in the face and to make your choice. And I have to say, those letters from those kids really were significant in my decision to continue the fight, because what they said to their supervisors, their elected officials, was, this matters to me. And not only the ways that it mattered to them, but, you know, one of the children said, when you really know what life is like for a little critter, it's like a son or a daughter to you. You know, that's the level at which that connection happens. And I think that's just our DNA, right? Like, we are wired for connection. We always were. This is a pretty novel thing we've been doing the last few thousand years, where in the last 100 or so here, where we don't have rooms full of naturalists in every school. So the stories weave together as one child shares what they know with another child and finds out that they're connected even in ways that they didn't realize at the outset. So in creating that curriculum, I'm not a teacher. I have no teaching credentials. I have no idea what I'm doing. So I'm stuck following my gut, I guess, and looking for people smarter than me. When we put together the curriculum, it's a 13-lesson teacher's manual binder and a critter catalog and a flower facts binder. And these materials are are laminated. They're color laminated materials back at a time when you couldn't afford color, so you had to reuse them. And each the critter catalog has, I think, 38 critters, all different groups. And we had to come up with a story that we could write at a fifth grade level about each of these organisms so they could become the expert. So I was looking back through these, and I remember this because it was hard work because the stories weren't out there. I would pick up the papers. I would scan through the kinds of things that sat on the shelf in my entomology department. And there were lots of facts. There was interesting stuff in there. But it didn't grab you because the stories were scrubbed out of it. You know, there was no story about a person doing this. It just got done. There was no story about, you know, what the observations of that person in the field, like what did you discover when you were out there baking in the sun? You know, like every one of us has been out there and had those experiences where you're like, oh my God, I never knew blank. And you notice. You wonder, it reminds you of things, and it starts the scientist in you, your wheels spinning, and it doesn't ever frickin' end because we never run out of things to look for. That is what I want kids to know, that it never runs out. Nature is turned on whether you're watching or not, and it will last a lifetime. But you need your introduction. You have to have a way in. So I put Christopher Rogers' name here because when I look at the water mite account, I remember down at the bottom, there was this story I heard from Christopher Rogers about the water boatman carrying a life stage of the water mite. And he wondered, he noticed that he didn't know how the water mite was getting from pool to pool. So he took some of his wife's fingernail polish and made a little dot on the back of, I don't know how many it was, 60, 100 water boatmen. And then he went around, bopping around, looking at vernal pools, and one day up in Chico, so he did this in Sacramento, and one day up in Chico, lo and behold, he starts seeing water boatmen with fingernail polish on them. So that's how he found out that they can fly at least 60 miles. So we captured that little story only because I could go ask Christopher Rogers. I mean, who are you going to ask, right? Whenever one of those children picks up a loop and a flower and looks into that, I know that the only reason they know some cool thing about that flower is Carol Witham gathered up those stories in her head and God knows where else and put together a flower facts binder of, I don't know, 40 plants. I mean, it's not like flowers have the kinds of stories critters do, but the kids love coming out on a flower field trip. You would just be amazed at how the search image they have in their heads from Carol's photo and how once you turn that on, they never forget how empowered they are to discover things. I remember going down to UC to Merced, and we did a pilot. Carol and I worked on a project. Carol got the grant money. I worked on the project to try to export this program to Merced because, you know, the biggest, best, greatest vernal pool landscapes left on the planet are there, and the people living there don't know what they have. And in the class that I took out, this little girl came up and she said, do you think I'm going to find my flower? And it was super dry. Oh my God, there's like nothing blooming. She goes, what's your flower? I asked. She goes, well, it's the tricolor monkey flower. And I'd been out there for 2 days and I hadn't seen like a hide a hair of it. So I said, geez, you know, I think we should keep looking. I haven't seen it, but you might be the one that finds it. So she's bopping around, and what I didn't realize is she's sort of circled around the backside of the vernal pool when the group was going with me in this direction. She had her dad with her. And she came running up to me, and she said, I found it. And I, the scientist, am thinking, isn't that cute that she thinks she found that plant? And she was ecstatic. What I did not realize till later in the day, I went back to the classroom to just debrief with the teacher. And she said, you know that that girl's dad was with us today. He teaches at UC Merced. And his daughter, apparently, was doing very poorly in school, which you can imagine for a PhD is probably hard to fathom. He was very worried about her. And after that day in the field, a two-hour field trip, the teacher said, "Well, what do you think now?" And he said, "She needs to be outdoors." And I think for me, if I hadn't been introduced to the outdoors, and I suspect for a lot of you, like, I can't even imagine what my life would have been like. So some kids can tolerate it, you know, they do just fine. But I think what I've seen is a lot of the kids that aren't doing fine, when they do splash, they rock it. They blow the top off of it in a way that sometimes their more, you know, able peers don't. And I see in that, I mean, after 20 years of this, you see patterns, and I see that the pattern is that it's to me like a criminal act that a child can go through life and never ever have the chance to discover their connection to the natural world. How do we let that happen? Well, I'm not, you know, given how easy it is to fix it, you know, every time they look at a plant, you know what they find out? They explore a little more and they find there's an insect on it. What's that insect? And the questions begin. We've had this long-horned fairy moth in and amongst the vernal pools at Mather for a long time. We notice it has this, you know, enormous antennae. And it wasn't until just a few weeks ago, Al Ludke called me up, and last year he went out to Mather with one of my buddies and discovered what the host plant for this is. It's valley tassels. So the discoveries are happening all the time. So this is where you come in. We wrote these accounts. We got that part done. We built the curriculum. And I'm looking back at it and thinking, well, this is just 48 species of animals and, you know, 40 species of plants. The questions the kids ask is like, what is that beetle? What is that fly? What is that insect? What's that moth with the antennae? I have no answers for them. I don't mean to have all the answers, but I do mean not to have, I want there to be a well where they can go with their questions or to find out some stuff other people have discovered. And we are out there. Nobody's asking us for that lovely story of what happened to you yesterday when that thing happened. But I'm asking you now. I need every one of you to either search your memory banks. If somebody sat you down and said, "Tell me the coolest things you've ever learned about life in vernal pools," I want you to, in a paragraph or two or three, in whatever language you use, I want you to write that story down. I want you to write it down and tell me why it mattered to you, and tell the kids why it still matters, so that they can see that we're not just talking to ourselves in highbrow language, but we're sharing what we know with this generation that's going to take it over after us. And so help me God, if they're not there, you know, we have a high hill to climb as it is, but it gets higher as we disappear. So my friend Bruce Russell helped me with flatworms. I didn't know there were so many flatworms. I had no idea what they did. And I said to the man, "Well, you know, what do the flatworms eat?" And he knew the answers because he noticed, he wondered, he took the time and watched. And that became a story. Greg Karafelis, you know, he's our resident dragonfly lepidopteran in Sacramento. And whenever we find some butterfly or odonate, you know, I can call Greg up. I can send him an email. And I can find out what that thing is. And then we can share it with the next kids. It's handing this information from one generation to the next, and it is our job. These are Greg's hands, and Greg is not getting younger, and I do not see a whole line of people coming up behind him to fill that void. And moreover, as I'm talking to people in their 60s and 70s, and they're saying, "I've never written down the stuff I know. Nobody's ever wanted to hear it. I want to hear it. I want you to write it down, and I want to create a community of scientists who are dedicated to making sure the things we know pass from us to them." The new discoveries, that new host plant for the fairy, for the longhorn fairy moth, valley tassels. You know, as I said, I see that all this connection starts with one kid, one animal, one flower. If that's the beginning, how far can they go if we're there to provide those stories and to model for them that when something's worth noticing, it's worth sharing so that they do it too? So this is what happens when you do a slide presentation in that elegant Mac program and then you translate it to a PowerPoint. So this did say, let your stories be bridges. Let them bridge the last generation to the next and their generation to the next. Let us make that bridge between urban life and something else. Something that, you know, you get so much insight listening to what kids say. There was a girl that came running up to me when she first got out in the field, and she said, "Who planted all these flowers?" They don't know that it happens without us, but it won't continue if we don't pay attention. They are looking to us. I am looking to you. I have come equipped. This is the first of, I hope, of a long conversation, but the fact is I'm just throwing a worm on a hook and I'm tossing it out to you, and I'm going to be trying to figure out if anything comes back, because I don't want to overpromise. Certainly don't want to disappoint them, but I don't really have a way to talk with you after this week, this two-day conference. So over there by the coffee and water bar, I put a little sign-up sheet. It says Friends of Splash, Vernal Pool Conference, April 2018. If you would like to be connected to us, that's the easiest way to begin. That conversation, we can develop mechanisms for that conversation to happen. We don't have to figure out exactly how yet, but I think it needs to start. Amongst this audience are people who are very generously donate to Splash. I want to thank you very much. That is what keeps us going. And I think in the future, as government funding and our other sources dry up, we were told years ago that this program is the kind of thing that can be supported by communities. It doesn't have to be at risk to government or changing administrations. I know that we are supposed to believe that 20 or 30 years ago we created a government institutions that were going to take care of these resources for us, and we put a lot of money into those efforts. And as a person who has focused most of my 25-year career on one place so that I could see what happens if you give your all, you gather people together, and you focus on one place, what is the story that emerges from that? And I have to say, at this point, the story that is emerging is that apparently there is a belief in the system that these vernal pools at Mather are owned by government, and that government will decide, and the pesky people are in the way, and we are not going away. Big Day of Giving is coming up for us. I've put together little flyers. I'll also put those over by the coffee bar. The first 20 people to pick one up also get a California Tiger Salamander tattoo. But do not worry, I have more. Just come talk to me. If you would like to, the Big Day of Giving is May. I'm going to shamelessly promote our fundraiser, and with an apology that I have to do this for those children. I think you understand where I'm coming from. If we don't do it, it won't get done. Anyway, the Big Day of Giving is a big event in the Sacramento region. It came along at a time when we were trying to build our private fundraising. We're a young, small, mighty organization. And last year was our third year to do Big Day of Giving. Of 560 nonprofits in the Sacramento region, our donors put us at number 14 for the number of donations and number 7 for the number of donors. I mean, it still is. It basically was just enough money to backfill the money we lost, not to grow, but to kind of grow backwards. So I have pledge cards. If you'd like me to do a pledge and prepare, all I need is to get some information from you, and I will log your pledge on the big day of giving, so you don't have to get up at 3 in the morning for us to win the $1,000 prize for the most donations in an hour. But I also have these posters. If you are from an office where you have peers or you have managers or people who might like to support this really wonderful program, I have these posters with a piece of artwork of a child with vernal pool critters dancing in their head. And it says, "I give to Splash because," and you get to fill that in and stick it up in your cubicle or wherever you work to let your peers know why Splash matters and how much we hope that they will be part of its long life. Thank you very much. Are we out of time for questions?
I think we might be able to take one or two quick questions.
Who gets the slot right before lunch, right?
Right? Any questions?
It's okay if you're just hungry. I won't take it personally.
Have you considered doing any satellite campuses in other regions?
Yes, very much so. We have a whole curriculum for Merced. It's awesome. It worked great. We piloted it for 2 years. It was some of the best work I've ever done. What we really had to do is sort of come back to, if we can't create a sustainable funding stream for Sacramento, what business do we have doing this someplace else? Because it's the reliability factor, right? Like, a teacher trains to do this, loves it, her children love it. The next year, those kids look forward to it. You cannot give and take that depending on funding. I still hope someday we find a way to do this in Merced. But I should just say, for all of you who work in vernal pools and other parts of the state, when Carol Witham, you know, was very instrumental in helping to build this, and I think she and I both share the belief that there's no proprietary aspect to this. If anybody wants to borrow it and make it place-based for where they live, do it. Like, we will help you do that. I would love to see it everywhere and anywhere vernal pools and kids meet.
Okay, thank you so much. What a great talk to finish up our session. I'd like to thank myself and our other speaker, Kirsten. And it's time for lunch.